Thanks for coming out. I just want to ask, Gil Fransdal gave a beginning meditation course that ended right before Thanksgiving. How many people took that course? Were there? Great. Yeah, I got to come to the first 4 or 5 weeks of that one. And also, Lee Lipp and Rana Kabat-Zinn gave a course on difficult mind states and working with them mindfully. Did anyone take that course? Great, yeah. Okay. I really love taking Gil's course again, because even though it sounds like I've had all this meditation experience, I feel really very much like a beginner. Every time I sit down to meditate, it's really the basic technique that we practice. And what it is aiming on the concentration object and really aiming on it and then holding it in our awareness and trying to really know it. Classically, that's sometimes called aiming and rubbing. That's really the goal of our practice. And it sounds so easy, but it's so challenging because there's so many things that take us off of that. So tonight, I've been asked, probably because I'm a master of the hindrances, to give a little talk on these classic hindrances to practice, all those things that do take us off the object of awareness, and how we might know those things, how we might work with them, how we might know them in the body, in the mind, etc. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to wear my glasses a little. I've got a cold and I'm not thinking 100%. So these hindrances, the translation of the Nivarana hindrance really means to cover over, from the Pali word. And that's exactly what these hindrances do. We have this object in our mind, and all of a sudden something comes up to disrupt the attachment to the object or the seeing of the object. So the hindrances are that aspect of the mind and the energy in the body that prevent us from seeing clearly, which is the object of our meditation, to know things just as they are. That's the joy of meditation, really, being able to sit with things as they truly are and not running away from them or not covering them over. So classically, we understand that each hindrance holds a particular kind of energy, and the Buddha has taught us that we need to understand these hindrances, because if we know them, we can work with them. And if we can work with them, we can understand them. And sometimes the understanding of something is the freedom from being bound to it. In the middle-length discourses, he talks in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness about this practice of working with hindrances. And the language is a little dense, but I love going to the classic texts, because you can go to the Majjhima Nikaya and go to the index and look up almost any topic and find something that's been said about it. And I find it really edifying to go back to the primary texts. The Buddha talked about knowing the hindrance, knowing it in our bodies and minds, knowing when it arises, knowing what it feels like as it's happening, being able to follow it, watching it pass, because all things come and go, we know this, understanding what it's like in our bodies and minds when we don't have the hindrance present, and then trying to figure out what conditions can be present to prevent those hindrances from arising. And it's said like this in Majjhima Nikaya number 10, actually, the Satipatthana Sutta, which I think is what Gil's course is about this year. So you can enter Gil's year-long course anytime. It's in the IMC website and the newsletters. This is just a fabulous sutta about the practice of meditation, the instruction about the practice of meditation. And so the hindrances are just one aspect. This is like the stuff that's hard and we don't like it, but it exists. And this is what he said just briefly. I'm going to read a few sentences. When the Buddha asked about bhikkhus, bhikkhus are the monks, and so he was often talking to the monks in the forest who came to learn from him. And this is what he said. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. And it goes on with the five hindrances, classic hindrances. The first is sensual desire. The second classical understanding of the hindrances is ill will or aversion. The third is that favorite enemy of mine, sloth and torpor. Fourth is restlessness and anxiety, and fifth is critical doubt. Now, two of those hindrances are paired. So sloth and torpor have sort of a mental and a physical aspect to it, the mental laziness and the physical looginess. And same with restlessness and anxiety. There's that physical restlessness and the mental anxiety that are parts of this particular hindrance. The hindrances are just phenomenon, just like anything else, just like hearing, just like seeing, just like sensation. They're universal, and it's not personal. They're not personally out to get you. They just exist. So what we know about them is that they visit all of us regularly, and they say only when one's reached the first stage of enlightenment are these hindrances suppressed in an ongoing way. Although we find that in really deep levels of concentration, actually during that period of concentration, the hindrances fall off. And it's really sort of an exquisite experience, that momentary understanding that those hindrances aren't there. Many people talk about Buddhism as having sort of a fatalistic and passive approach to life. You know, we just sort of hang out with the way things are. But I really have come to feel that Buddhism is not for wimps, or Buddhist practice isn't. And I don't think it was any mistake that the Buddha actually was from the Kshatriya, the warrior caste in India. Because it's really tough to be with the mind. I mean, it's really tough to be with things as they are. We're often finding ourselves running off or covering over things. And the Buddha said that it's easier for a warrior to battle 1,000 enemies in 1,000 battles than to take on the training of the mind. And that's exactly what we're doing in Buddhist practice, or in meditation, mindfulness practice, is we're just training the mind to allow ourselves to be with things as they are, unencumbered. It's a sort of a deconstructionist approach to just being with how things are. As I said, you know, the idea is aiming and rubbing on the object, and we find that we can get on something and then all of a sudden we're off. And it's disconcerting, but it's just the practice. In Theravadan psychology, in the Abhidhamma, or as the Burmese call it, the Abhidhamma, the psychology of consciousness, it said that no two objects can be present in your awareness at the same time. So in other words, if I'm on my breath, I'm on my breath, even if something then pulls me off, then the next second I'm with that. But so the great thing about this, not to be a Pollyanna about it, but if you're pulled off into a hindrance, if you feel or experience a hindrance, if you can see it, if you can note it, if you can know it, then we're really doing the deepest practice. We're really seeing things as they are. I mean, we may not like the experience of them. We were hoping, you know, for a little light, a little lightness, whatever. But if we can just be with things and note them and know them, that is the practice. So the hindrances are sometimes called the enemy of meditation, but really they don't have to be. It's just that they're really, really challenging. And Gill has sometimes referred to them like the dark holes of meditation, because you're tootling along on your breath or on a sensation, and all of a sudden, you're just gone. You know, you're gone somewhere. And we'll talk about all the somewheres, or some of the somewheres you can go. But you eventually, you do squirt out the other end. And sometimes you can, you know, bypass the hole, and sometimes you're in a zone, as I used to tell my Saido in Burma, Saido, today I was really in the zone. And he's like, oh, I guess that's very good. Because I could work with them as they arose. Working with them as they arise, for me, is sort of like being a sailor in the San Francisco Bay. Because not only do you have your craft, you have to really know the conditions of the sea, and you have to work with the changing conditions. But you also really do have to study the tide tables. You do have to know where there are shallows and where there are deep waters. You have to know where there are sunk things that you can hit. And the Buddha actually had a simile about water as well, which was a likening the mind to a clear forest pond. And the hindrances were like visitations to this clear forest pond that disallowed you to look to the bottom, to the depths. And so sensual desire is the first hindrance. And he likened that to like dyes being poured in all over the pond. And these beautiful colors reflecting on the water. And one becomes sort of mesmerized by all these colors and patterns and therefore doesn't sink to the depths and doesn't look to the depths. And this is what he called the hindrance of sensual desire. The second hindrance is ill will. And you know, do you remember those cartoon characters when they'd get really mad and the steam would go out of their ears? They'd be boiling mad. In this simile that the Buddha presented, anger and ill will is like boiling water. And when the boiling water is happening, again, it's creating conditions where you can't penetrate down into it. The third one, my favorite, sloth and torpor, are all these algae growing in the water, making it very, very thick and very heavy. And even if it's beautiful water lilies, they're still in the way of really seeing the depths, penetrating the depths. You stay on the surface, or you stay at the depth where the algae is growing. Restlessness, he likened to the wind, and it's like how the wind puts ripples on the water, and a little stick will flit here and there, or a leaf on the water is going here and there. And what he was suggesting was the mind, taken over by restlessness, doesn't allow itself to sit on the object. It goes from object to object to object, and therefore never penetrates knowing them very well. A lot of thinking occurs in that particular hindrance. And finally, in the classic five hindrances, is skeptical doubt. And skeptical doubt, he has likened to mud stirred up from the bottom of this pond. And the mud also makes the water very murky, and so we can't penetrate to the depths to see things as they are. So tonight I thought what I would do, we don't have much time. Can I have the clock just so I know? Thank you very much. So there's so much to say about these hindrances. There's been a lot written about the hindrances, and certainly if you go on a meditation retreat the first several days, the teachers talk a lot about the hindrances because it's a big part of our practice. But tonight I thought what I would do is go actually over all five hindrances and talk a little bit about the experience of them, what you might look for, and what you might try to do with regards to working with them. And I would also then advise you to go to our beautiful Audio Dharma website, which I don't know if you've discovered yet, but it's just this fabulous website. Gil gave a course on the hindrances where he took every hindrance and spent a whole session on them. And so you get a much more in-depth perspective if you listen to that. The first hindrance then is sensual desire. And it's no mistake that that's number one, because it's just a predominant, prevalent hindrance. It's that aspect of the mind that's yearning and grasping. And we do it all day long. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to go after something, but in meditation, it pulls us off the object. So you might notice that your body is leaning forward into something. You know, you can really, if you look at what you're experiencing in the body, you might actually have the physical sensation of moving forward, looking for something, or wanting something. And that is one of the physical manifestations of it. There are some very dramatic manifestations of sensual desire. One, of course, is the affliction of addictions. They're completely compelling and devastating. But there are, you know, the whole gambit of sensual desire. It's not just sexual desire. It's not what he's talking about. It's anything, any desirable object, whether it's a color, a taste, a sensation, a thought, a feeling, anything that gives you, that you're reaching for, really, that takes you off of just what there is right now. Now, what there is right now might be a pleasant feeling, but we're talking about something else that's pulling you away from right here. Have any of you gone on a 10-day meditation retreat? There's a funny story that's told oftentimes about 10-day meditation retreats or longer meditation retreats with regards to sensual desire, and it's called the Vipassana Romance. And it's a great and funny example of sensual desire where you're sitting quietly, you don't talk to other people, although a really lovely atmosphere develops of support in a group, and you notice someone over there and they really look great. And you're really compelled, you really are attracted to that person. And that person really can begin to be the topic of many thoughts and fantasies. You don't know this person, but you want them. In fact, the teachers report that people go in from day to day and talk about, you know, I'm thinking about this person, and then the next day I'm thinking about what it'd be like to be with this person physically. I'm thinking about what it'd be like to be married to this person. They can go through the whole relationship. And really what it is just this sensual desire attaching to an object. So, you know, that's one sort of funny example. But what if you're sitting in meditation or you're in a meditation retreat and you start feeling a little prickly sensation on your skin, it's a goosebump, and you realize you're a tiny bit chilly. And you think, oh gosh, I'm chilly, I should get up and get my blanket. It's, you know, in the car, or it's in the other room. And you're thinking about it, and then you look over and you see, oh, she's got a beautiful blanket. You know, she brought it. I wonder where she got it. I wonder if there's a yogi catalog. You know, there's these great yogi catalogs that come in the mail now. I could probably order it. When I get home, I'm going to look up all Dharma product catalogs. I'm going to find that beautiful, beautiful blanket because I think if I weren't cold, I could meditate well. Hopefully, you don't bolt for your room and get your blanket, you know. Or you might think, oh, what is the matter with me? You know, I never come prepared to meditation. I mean, here I'm on a retreat. I made my list. I brought my blanket. I left it in my room. So here we see a whole bunch of hindrances. We see desire. We see aversion, the thought, the judgment against ourselves, and probably some restlessness if we're thinking we're going to get up and move. So you can see how one little goosebump that isn't painful or harmful can lead to this awareness and analysis, really, of a lot of mind states that are very valuable to look at. How do we work with sense desire? Well, let me just tell you, it's a little embarrassing, but I had an experience a few months ago in meditation pertaining to this. It's my practice that I'm pretty tired at this time of day, so I don't meditate at home at this hour. I get up in the morning before I go to work, and I meditate in the mornings before I get in the car and go. Usually, up until a few months ago, my pattern, my habit was to get up in the morning, make a pot of tea, have a cup of tea, do a tiny little bit of chanting and meditation, and then come back and have my tea and practice, breakfast, I mean. So I was running a little late, so I quickly made my tea, and I hadn't finished my cup of tea, and I took it to my meditation corner of my little office. And the cup's sitting over there, and I'm looking at the clock, and it's like, okay, I'm going to meditate. I have 45 minutes to meditate this morning. So I always, which I'm going to really, really advise you later, I always decide how long I'm going to meditate, because these hindrances are so tricky. If you don't decide how long you're going to meditate, they're going to pull you off your cushion. So, okay, I'm going to meditate 45 minutes. The next, 15 minutes go by. I'm sort of watching my breath. I'm with things. All of a sudden, I have this teacup, and I'm drinking the tea. I mean, it was so terrible, crazy, because I was so unaware of what happened that I don't know what the mind moment was before. I think I might have smelled the tea. And I think it was the smell of that Lion Mountain Kimun tea that prickled my senses, and before I knew it, I was just grabbing the tea. And it wasn't like in my imagination. It was in my hand, and I'm like, I was really struck by how easy it is to just get seduced by these things. So I'm thinking about this still 2 and 3 months later, just not chastising myself, but just the power of these hindrances. It's really quite striking. And nothing bad happened. I drank some tea and I put it down, but it was that lack of awareness that was really pronounced at that moment. So what do we do about sensual desire? How do we work with it? Classically, the Buddha, you know, was trying to protect his monks. And, of course, he's trying to protect his monks from the beautiful women in India and Burma and wherever. And so his classic advice to his Sangha was, if you see someone that you think is really, really attractive, you know, you might think, oh, gosh, she's got such beautiful eyes and her beautiful face. And so then think, hair. Is hair attractive? Are fingernails attractive? Or what other parts of a body, what other body products might not be that object of your desire? I mean, what are you really desiring? Can you deconstruct it a little bit? And it's not to be repulsed by the body. It's just to take in the whole thing and to really try and understand, what is it really? Is it that body or is it some energy? To try and really see it and understand it. For that reason, on meditation retreats, they ask people not to wear really tight, sensual clothing. Because it's just so tempting, you know, to see each other and say, whoa, whoa. So to be respectful to the fact that these things occur, we try and be respectful about that and mindful. In terms of other aspects that sort of get the sensual desire going, you know, when you read the newspaper, do you read all the ads? It's more than 50% ads, isn't it? So you're trying to read an article and all of a sudden there are 24 mobile phones and stereos and the newest technology and are you aware of it grabbing you or does it? You know, maybe it doesn't. That's great, but maybe it does. And the Sunday paper is just nefarious. So do you spend time with the Sunday paper, you know? Be careful. I don't go shopping with some friends. Because, like, my husband and I both hate to shop. We're great. We go in, we get what we want, we're out of there. But if I go with my cousin, she loves everything. She wants to try everything on. She's a great shopper. I get sucked in. You know, I have to try it too, and I don't need that stuff. Some of it I need, a lot of it I don't need. So, sensual desires, a lot about observing a little bit of constraint, not to be harsh with the self, but just to ask oneself, you know, do I need this? Do I need that? And classically, again, the advice is to identify a teacher who models that and good friends who model that and to spend time in their presence because that's very inspiring and motivating. Basically, you know, we're training our minds and our hearts. It's not just that we're observing phenomenon coming and going. We're really observing it and knowing it. So there's some energy required there. That's why I say, you know, it's a challenging practice. And so to be with other people who are also committed to doing that is very, very helpful. On retreats, they say it's probably a good idea not to overindulge in food for a number of the hindrances, but one is just because you get so primed. And of course, one of the things that we all look forward to on retreat is that meal, because it's like the thing that's going to be stimulating to the senses. So some of us line up really early for lunch. Just, it really does happen. There are some factors of meditation that are classically said to be antidotes to these hindrances. And the hindrance of sensual desire is said to be worked with by concentration. If we can concentrate on an object, if we can keep coming back to the object, then we're not pulled off into all of these other places. So as our concentration develops, that pull of sensual desire is easier to work with. The second hindrance that's classically discussed is ill will or aversion. It's really the opposite energy. In the first hindrance of sensual desire, we're leaning forward, we're grasping these objects. And with ill will, we're pushing away, denying, and judging, and being irritated, and being angry. So it has a really different energy in the body. If you begin to experience that kind of thought, look in your body and see. I usually start pushing on my legs, like I start getting tense. Or there's a clenching sometimes, or the breath changes. Can you note it? Can you pay attention to those physical and mental contents to this hindrance? It's, again, a pervasive aspect of mental functioning. It's not personal. It, again, is triggered by certain things. subtle things and gross things. Sometimes when you read the paper and it's really scary, there's a lot of aversion that arises, or movies or television things that are really scary and gory. On retreat, it can be as little as the person next to you being restless when they come in, and all of a sudden you are just furious at that person for wrecking your meditation. They're just noisy every time, and it's so interesting to watch how our mind attaches, because if you weren't caught in that, you wouldn't be feeling that way about that noise. You'd be hearing the noise, or if someone were really restless, you might feel some compassion. You know, it's just really interesting that when that phenomenon is occurring, how your mind attaches to it. Again, like all the hindrances, the first instruction is to be mindful of it and to just pay attention to the mental content, but not the story. You know, this is where I get caught sometimes. It's sort of like with desire or any of these. I know what the story is. I'm upset about this or I'm mad about that. So then I say, well, I'll just finish this thought and then I'll go back to my meditation. But really what I want to do is just be aware of this thought, thinking, you know, thinking. So I'm just thinking, or I'm planning, or I'm judging, or I'm ranting in my mind. And then I want to come back. So it's just that fact of really being mindful sometimes is really freeing. And not always. I mean, you can sit all day with anger, anger, anger. That can happen sometimes when you're really worked up. But that's okay. I mean, it will change. It really does change. Sometimes it takes many, many mind moments. Sometimes it doesn't. It's really variable. The classic antidote to aversion is goodwill, joy, rapture, and metta. So sometimes you'll be advised, if you're really stuck in this place of having an averse mind, not to really think about it too much while you're doing your practice, but when you're off the cushion, say, can you forgive yourself if you're being harsh on yourself? Can you forgive someone else if you're feeling really angry or hurt or angry or mad at them? This is called metta practice in our tradition, and it's a really kind of radical kindness where you wish well to someone. That's one antidote. The other antidote that's classically discussed is something the Dalai Lama was talking about in November when he was here giving a few talks. And he talked about really reflecting on the fact that when you're upset or sending ill will towards someone, you're really burning up yourself. That I don't know what effect it has on someone else because I don't know about that stuff. But I do know that I hurt myself when I am consumed with anger. And so he asks people to reflect on the fact that they're harming themselves with this anger. And because he believes in karma or understands karma, he's saying, please understand that you're conditioning your future mind moments. Now, I can understand that in my lifetime. I am conditioning. I'm wearing the rut of anger. You know, if you're angry, angry, angry today, you might be more inclined to be angry tomorrow. It's just these mind ruts you get into. In Theravadan Buddhism, or Mahayana Buddhism for that matter, they take it the next step and say it conditions future lives and future, the next mind moments that I don't personally know about, but I hear what he's saying. So that's ill will, vipada. The next one is sloth and torpor. And this is the one that's just challenged me so much in my practice for many, many years. Sloth and torpor is that energy of the mind that is just thick and dense. And it's that quality of the mind that doesn't allow you to really target the object. And when you are on an object, you just sort of slide off of it. And it's that feeling that sometimes you're meditating, all of a sudden you just feel like you're going to fall asleep or you're going to swoon. There's some discrimination that sort of has to go in there because in our society we're just deprived of sleep. We run on exhaustion sometimes. So when we get into meditation, we are sometimes tired. So that's a true state. So we need to discriminate between being physically really tired and this other condition that can arise right in the middle of a meditation that's going. You know, all of a sudden you're just visited by this. At the beginning of meditation retreats, often, the first couple of days, the teachers talk about this a lot because people are settling in and need to get their rest. really need to take their nap after lunch, really need to be kind to themselves and rejuvenate and restore themselves so they have the energy to do the work of meditation, because it isn't just a bliss state, it is a practice where you're directing your mind and it takes some energy. I was shocked by this sloth and torpor. I mean, I just was shocked by the power of it. And for many years, whenever I'd sit down, I'd either feel physical agony or I'd want to fall asleep. And I really think that the hindrances are really also defenses, because I think the hindrances pull us away from what is. And I think if what is sort of a difficult state, a difficult memory or a difficult idea, the hindrances act to cover that over. As a psychologist, I've developed this idea that some of the hindrances work stronger in some personality types. I'm like, from a Freudian point of view, sort of a hysterical type, and denial would be a pretty bad coping mechanism, but it's sort of denying reality, and that's sort of what sloth and torpor do. It just dulls you out, you know, so that you can't see things as they are. But over time, I've really found that that's less the case for me, and also that if I can pay attention to it right when it starts happening, like if I can really note that sleepy feeling, then I'm bringing mindfulness to my practice. And not every time, but as I'm feeling sleepy, if I'm noting sleepy, or where the sort of sluggishness is in my body, then my mindfulness can actually wake me up. That's a pretty subtle antidote. There are so many antidotes to sloth and torpor because it's such a big issue for people. And so I'm going to sort of go through a list of some of the ones that people recommend. One is to sit up straighter. That if you bring your posture into a more alert position, you might bring energy to your practice. Sometimes you'll see, even in a meditation here, when people are feeling really, really sleepy or overwhelmed with sloth and torpor, they'll stand up. Because if you're standing up, you're going to be really embarrassed if you just fall right over. So it sort of keeps you energized a little more. Sometimes they say on retreat, if you're having such a hard time, go out and do walking meditation. Because with walking meditation, you're bringing up a little more body energy. When I was in Ananda Marga, my teacher always recommended that we bathe in cold water, our hands from our elbows down and our legs down, back of our necks before meditation, also has a sort of a stimulating effect to the body. And classically also, some people are advised to open their eyes, which is a fine way of bringing more energy in, or sitting in front of a bright light, even if your eyes are closed. Traditionally, I've never tried that, but this is another technique. For myself, I really avoid meditating at night when I'm tired and can be more easily discouraged. My best practices are in the morning, and that's where I am, unless I'm on retreat, that's when I spend most of my time meditating. Although, since it's so wonderful to meditate with other people, I also take advantage of the opportunity to meditate with our Sangha when I can, because of the energy that seems to be generated by that. So that's sloth and torpor. You know, this aspect I've been talking about aiming on the object and then rubbing, that aiming process is classically seen as an antidote for sloth and torpor, because if you just keep aiming, I mean, even if you keep falling off, it's okay. It's all practice. The very next aim is mindfulness. The very next aim. It doesn't matter how many aims come in a row. The very next aim is a moment of mindfulness. It's a moment of the opportunity to be free. It's really quite powerful. So the next one is restlessness and anxiety, that ripple on the lake. With that one, the body can have lots of energy waves. You can feel like you want to bolt from the pillow. This is the one where your mind just flits from object to object to object. If possible, if you can bring your mind back, you're training it not to flit. But of course, sometimes it will flit, and you just be mindful of it, and you come back when you can. Gill has recommended that people try and really follow the energy in their bodies when your body's feeling restless, because it's very powerful. You can feel these energy surges and you can pay attention to them. And in that way, you really begin to focus and be mindful again. It's a practice. And I read somewhere, and I'm not sure where, a really nice treatment of restlessness, which is if there's a bunking bronco in a stall, it can really get hurt if it hits the walls of the stall. So if you give it more spaciousness, more freedom, so if you open up your awareness and not try and focus so much here, but maybe on your whole body, then also you might find a little bit more calm and then more focus. We could discuss that more if you want to in a minute. The last classical hindrance is called skeptical doubt. And skeptical doubt is sort of the hardest one to deal with. And skeptical doubt is the one that says, oh God, I've been sitting here for 20 minutes and nothing's happened. And this is so stupid. And I could have been, you know, writing a letter, or why did I come to a 10-day meditation retreat when I could have gone to Mexico and really relaxed? Or who is this teacher? I mean, why would I think he's got something he can teach me? Or these texts, I mean, they're written 2,500 years ago. Are they relevant? It's powerful. It's a powerful thing because the mind is looking for an opportunity to move off. And those are good questions. I mean, those are really reasonable questions to ask yourself. You should probably just ask yourself them, not while you're sitting on your cushion. You know, when you're on your cushion, they're a way of getting off of where you are. If you're off the cushion, there are very important questions to ask before you decide you really want to study meditation with a teacher or want to pursue retreats. The thing about doubt is it is dispelled by experience. And the Buddha said, you know, I've solved my problems, now you solve yours. And he gave very specific techniques for us to do our own work. No one can do it for us. In this tradition, there is no guru who zaps you with a peacock feather and you're enlightened. I tried that. It didn't work. You know, for years I tried that. It just, you know, it was blissful, but it didn't bring me the wisdom that I knew I was really longing for. The Buddha has given us techniques of mindfulness and concentration that allow us to see things. And as our practice develops, we can really see the benefits. I can really see the benefit in my life of my practice. I find it really quite profound. And early on in my practice, I think what was really helpful to me was having teachers I could go to and say, what is this about this? You know, do I have to believe anything? And the answer in this tradition is always, you don't have to believe anything. You just have to practice. You don't have to believe about karma. You don't have to believe in, I don't know, anything. I mean, there isn't a whole lot to believe. There's just the practice of watching unfolding of things moment to moment. And what we see is that things change, that there's unsatisfactoriness with some phenomenon, and that some of these things aren't personal. These things aren't personal. And that's the truth. It really can bring a radical shift in the way we understand ourselves, the way we see ourselves. It can lead to a lot of freedom. So classically, it is thought that a way of dealing with doubt is to study the texts, if that's helpful, of being with good Dharma friends who've had a little bit more experience that you can ask questions to, and of finding a teacher who you think is pretty good. I mean, I certainly think here at IMC we have a fabulous teacher who really can explain things. I've felt very, very helped over the years by our teacher here. In the process, while we're sitting, if this arises, we note it. We know what it is. It's not unfamiliar to us. Everybody experiences it. It's not like your personal suffering. It's doubt. It's got conditions. It's got a sinking feeling to it. If you feel it, it's like debilitating. You know, it's like, I can't do this, or I don't want to do this. You know, whatever, that's more like aversion, but you know, that sort of pulling back and sinking in feeling, or whatever it is for you. You have to find how you experience in your body and in your breath. Within the process of meditation, they say if you can continue to focus on objects, if you can hear a sound, or if you can feel your butt on the pillow, if you can keep coming back to some specific thing in the moment, it can help you break a doubt cycle, because if you're really paying attention to something else, you can't pay attention to that. It breaks it up. The good news about all of this is these are just opportunities to practice, and that it really does seem to get easier once you know these things really well, and that that's really the opportunity we have, is to be scientists about it. I want to read something from one of my very favorite teachers about hindrances, about sort of encouraging us with the hindrances. This is from Joseph Goldstein's Insight Meditation book. I highly recommend all of his work, and he's a founding teacher at IMS. And I'm just going to read one paragraph on his chapter on hindrances here. Another thing to remember as you deepen the systematic exploration of your mind in practice is the fact that though the unwholesome qualities of consciousness appear to be getting stronger, in fact, they are not. You are only becoming more aware of them. As practice deepens, we can feel overwhelmed by the multitude of different mental hindrances that arise. We see restlessness, laziness, anger, doubt, greed, conceit, envy, and all the rest. And it sometimes seems that our mind contains nothing but these afflictive emotions. A traditional Buddhist analogy describes this phenomenon. If you have a cloth full of grime and dirt, no particular spot on it stands out. But as the cloth becomes cleaner, each stain becomes more obvious. In this same way, as our mind becomes clearer and more lucid in meditation practice, the hindrances show themselves more noticeably. So keep a balanced perspective as you work with thoughts and emotions in your mind and heart. It is important to see the hindrances as they arise and to understand that the clarity to see them comes precisely from this growing purity of your consciousness. One final note. One thing that has really, really helped me in my practice, especially with regards to the hindrance, is to put a fixed schedule for my practice. And I don't mean like saying, okay, today I'm going to meditate for an hour, today I'm going to meditate for an hour and a half. I mean really be realistic about your meditation practice. You know, 30 minutes, 20 minutes is a good period of time to meditate if you can bring your energy to it. So that when you're meditating, you're really meditating and not just daydreaming like many of us do for years on our cushions. You know, if we say, in this period of practice, I'm going to meditate for 20 minutes and I'm going to try and be mindful, at the end of 20 minutes, you've conditioned your mind so much better than if you daydream for an hour. So I always, when I sit down, look at my little clock and decide what time I'm going to get up. And oftentimes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 15 minutes before, my eyes pop open and I think, is it time? Is it time? No. It's not time. What's going on? I've got time. I've made the time. I know I have the time. So that's one suggestion I would really offer you. Recently, I've come to sort of understand working with the hindrances. For me, I've sort of begun thinking of myself like a glass blower who has that flame. Have you ever seen a glass blower? They have this welder's torch almost. And they can change the flame depending on what they want to do with it. If they need to cut through something, they sharpen the flame, they turn a dial, and it becomes like this laser sharp flame, which is the energy I bring to sloth and torpor. If I see it coming, I know I need to gear up, hone in, be mindful in the moment of sloth and torpor, notice it right away and pay particular attention. If I'm upset with myself or with someone else and I feel like I need to soften things, or if I'm tense and averse, I undo the mental dial and I have this sort of warming energy that sort of warms me. We develop these toolkits for ourselves, and everybody's toolkit's a little bit different. Thanks for letting me share what I have come to read and understand and know about, keep learning about these hindrances. And if you have any questions, we have 10 minutes to ask questions, or if you want to share any of your own experiences, be happy to Happy to hear those too. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm new to this practice.
Great.
It's wonderful. I'm a little confused. Am I to use the mindfulness of the breath during the day when I'm out going about my life, or is that a practice to, well, only while I'm sitting on the cushion, to teach me to be mindful of whatever it is I'm concentrating on during the day? I'm a little confused.
Okay, well, that's a really good question. And I'll tell you what I think, and then you can ask Gil also, okay? But you can come to have some moments of paying attention to your breath during the day. But obviously, we're out in an external world where we're not going to be paying attention. However, there are times when you're sitting at your desk or sitting at your kitchen table when you can think about, focus on a couple of breaths. And if we can just focus on a breath from the moment we connect with the in-breath all the way in and all the way out, like a whole breath cycle, that's a really good breath. You know, it's not like having to pay attention to your breath for 7 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. If we can really focus on the object, aim on it, and hold it in and hold it out, then we're training our minds and our hearts, really. We're allowing to really be with something. Now, you could do that washing dishes, too. You could watch your hand turning on the water. You could watch your hand. You could be aware of the sensations of picking up the soap and squeezing it, of the seeing the frothy bubbles. Awareness is every moment, but it's not always the breath that I'm predominantly aware of.
So I'm not to try to do that, be aware of the breath simultaneously with something else. As you said, you can only be aware of one thing.
Right, although that one thing goes so fast that we're aware of multitasking. I had a friend in Burma who asked our Sayadaw, well, Sayadaw, I can watch my breath while I'm doing this and that and the other thing, because in America we're really good at multitasking. And Sayadaw said, forget about it. You know, just watch your breath. It's a, you know, the breath is an easy phenomenon because it's like in and out, either at the nostrils or at the abdomen, wherever you choose to follow it. And it has a course. It has a, like, almost an intention to breathe sometimes, or you experience the in-breath, you experience it maybe the rising of the abdomen and all the sensations and the fall of the abdomen and the out-breath. I experience it here at the nostrils, the sensation in and out. And so it's really a clear object, so it's easy. Like walking meditation, you're aware of your foot being raised and moved forward and placed. And you're aware of the firmness when it hits the ground and the release when it comes up. So no, I don't think you need to worry about watching your breath every second. You'd probably drive yourself crazy.
I think so.
One of my favorite early teachers, her name was Kamala Masters. She's a great meditation teacher. And she had a teacher who lived in her house with her for a while. I forget his name. And he suggested that when she opened the door handle of her house, she be aware of all the movements. So sometimes people are encouraged to pick one aspect of their practice. Opening the door, listening to the telephone, something that brings you back to really paying attention to what it is. Yeah. And Thich Nhat Hanh's big on that too, if you ever read his books. Listening to the bell or... Yeah. You know, this is the first week in the liturgical calendar for Catholicism. I have a friend and we've made a deal. She's reading Buddhist texts and I'm going to Mass with her. And we've found a wonderful, I mean, just this awesome Vietnamese priest in Oakland. And on Sunday, he started the Mass by ringing the ringing of the meditation bowl. He was outside. And then his voice said, wake up. Be alert. This is the beginning of the new year. Pay attention. And I was so blown away by this. And then he said, we're going to be quiet and find that still place. I thought he was just doing it for me, you know. And then out of that silence came the incense and the procession. It was really quite beautiful. So just out of the sound of the bell and really listening and being quiet, a lot can develop. Thanks a lot for coming.